Duho strained to get away, and Ursula grabbed her braids at the base of her skull, pulled her face so close to her own and held it there that they could have kissed if they hadn't wanted to kill each other instead. "I will not let you endanger the rest of us, too. If you give up one more time, I will throw you out of this caravan. I will leave you behind."
"Please," Intisar begged.
"Don't be afraid,"
Duho whispered.
"There's nothing to be afraid of."
"Do it again and watch me keep my word," Ursula said. I held Intisar in terror, waiting for something horrible. An absence, a shifting, an addition to reality. The only one strong enough to stop Duho if she tried something was Ursula, because they had both forgotten so much. But she would have to use the magic right back to thwart anything Duho tried to do, and none of us know how much Ursula has left. What if what it took from her was the memory of how to drive?
"I'm sorry,"
Duho finally said. Her cheeks were wet then.
"I don't know if I can stop it."
"You can," Ursula said. She pointed at Duho's twin sister, and they studied each other's identical features. "You have to." She tried. Intisar watched her, and Victor and Isabel watched Wes. We wound around the circular lands. Every revolution made them more and more agitated, as if each turn hurt.
"How much longer can it go on like this?"
Intisar asked Ursula softly one night as we drove under the glow of Duho's unnaturally luminous moon. Everything shone silver, almost as bright as day. "I don't know," Ursula said, "but there has to be an end."
"Maybe it's a test," I offered. "Maybe whoever is waiting in New Orleans made the land like this so only those who really want to go will make it."
"Maybe it's a warning,"
Duho said then. She wiped the sweat from her tired, furrowed brow.
"Maybe they made it like this because they don't want us to come."
"No," Ursula said. "The stories are about the welcoming one, not the unwelcoming one." On the fourth day, the road finally uncoiled into a straight, long line. We came around the last bend and all gasped. Ursula had to stop the RV for a moment so we all could take it in. An endless stretch of green with a single gray ribbon straight through it, extending out until it faded against the horizon.
"We made it," I finally said. "We can't be far." "I can't see anything at all," Isabel mused, squinting. "Just green."
Ursula nodded determinedly. "New Orleans is out there."
"What's New Orleans?"
Wes asked from behind us, studying the landscape from beneath the shade of his palm.
"It's where we're going."
"No, we're not," Duho said.
Outside the RV, we stood clustered in two groups, one beside each tired taillight. The ones who wanted to remember, Ursula, me, Isabel, Victor, and Intisar, and the ones who didn't, Duho and Wes. Wes was pacing listlessly in vague circles, as if trailing some sort of shifting magnetic attraction. But Duho was still, staring calmly into Intisar's eyes. In the dirt behind us, tiny little light bulbs the size of grapes were pushing slowly through the earth, unfurling like new crops. Farther back, a carved porcelain teacup the size of a freighter sailed silently past in the sky like a cloud, its smooth, rounded lip tilted at a graceful angle.
"Please, Duho,"
Intisar said.
"Don't do this."
Duho shook her head.
"Trust me, Walasha. Transcendence was right. Not that we should follow them, but that there's so much more out there than whatever might be in New Orleans. I can feel it."
"Let's just go there first," Intisar begged. "If you don't like it, we can leave."
"No,
It's a mistake. Trying to save what we used to have. That isn't the way. We have this power for a reason. We're supposed to use it. We're supposed to make something new.
Intisar wiped her face fiercely, to slap off the tears before they trickled down.
What about me?
She asked.
I don't want to be new. I want to remember.
I know you don't understand yet, Duho said. But you will soon.
I can show you.
Intisar turned to us.
If we go faster, we can make it,
she said hurriedly.
If you help me get her back inside, I can hold her. I can remember for the both of us.
Ursula sighed. If it had been possible, Duho and Intisar would be the ones who could do it. But it wasn't possible. We promised, I finally said. The tea kettle was passing now, following after the cup. Birds clustered on its spout like dust. The porcelain gleamed in the setting sun. We have to get everyone there, even if they don't remember that they wanted to go.
I will not go, Duho said firmly. I will undo the vehicle if you try and force me.
We all tensed. Ursula spread her arms protectively, as if her hands could stop anything from reaching the RV.
The RV is ours, she said. It's going to New Orleans.
Are you sure?
Duho asked. She looked at Wes.
Maybe it's going somewhere else.
There was a small, groaning sigh behind us then. The beginning of something. Or the end.
Duho! No!
Intisar screamed. I felt my breath catch, but I couldn't look at what was behind us now. It was death. Emptiness.
Ori. I couldn't move. But Ursula could. All the air came back into the world suddenly. Everything was a few iterations lighter, like I'd taken off a hat and a coat. I turned and looked. The RV was still the same. It was still the same. It was as I remembered it.
Go before I kill you, the silver-haired woman said quietly.
Duho nodded. She was slicked with sweat, damp from forehead to her shoes. Humid stains crept through her clothes at her armpits, her knees.
I'm sorry, she said at last. I would have let it go. I didn't mean to... what you had to give up.
Go before I kill you, she said again.
Duho turned slowly and strode off toward the distant hills, almost floating over the ground. Wes considered for a long moment.
I'm sorry, too, he said softly.
He turned to follow his new liminal queen. I hugged Intisar before she could say anything.
Stay, I said. Stay and remember. She's my sister,
Intisar whispered helplessly.
I can't leave her.
I know, I said. Her hand slipped out of mine. Then there were only four of us, standing beneath Duho's glowing moon. I turned around at last and touched the aluminum side of the vehicle. It felt solid. Real. The RV's okay? Everything's okay? I asked desperately. Our driver nodded, exhausted. But instead of going back toward the RV, she turned and walked away, into the tall grass waving in the field stretching away from the road. She walked faster and faster.
Wait! I cried. I chased after her. Where was she heading? None of us could drive the RV but her. Wait!
But she just kept going until she was moving at a run.
Stop!
And then she disappeared. But no, she'd only dropped to her knees, and the grass had appeared to swallow her. I slowed as I came up behind the gap in the sea of weeds where her body had crumpled the stalks beneath her. She wasn't moving, just kneeling there, staring into the distance in silence. The grass hissed softly around us.
I'm sorry,
she finally said. Her voice was thick.
I need it.
It's all right, I said.
It's going to start happening much faster now.
I know, I breathed. We had all felt it. The size of what had been lost to save the RV. It was a big thing. An anchoring thing. We had so few of those left.
We should go. There isn't time to waste anymore.
In a moment, I edged forward and sat down beside her, as quietly as I could. We have a moment. She looked down at her hands.
A moment, she conceded at last.
I waited for her to tell me what she'd just given up. Then I realized what it was. I don't remember it either, I said. Somehow she had forgotten it, and then forgotten it for all of us as well. I'm sorry. She shook her head.
It's all right.
There was nothing more to do about it. Except just forget more. The woman climbed to her feet. In the moonlight, she shimmered lightly.
It was just a name. There was hardly anything left to it anyway.
We have been driving a long time, I think. I can't see where we came from. There's nothing around us for miles. Wherever it was, it's too far away to know now. The air is warm. And the road is straight. Where are we going? I asked the woman driving next to me when I saw her glance over.
It's a place called New Orleans, she said patiently.
New Orleans, I repeated. What a wonderful sounding place, don't you think, Ori? A place that's new. A place for starting over. I don't know what Orleans means, but it also sounds like your name. I don't think I ever believed much in signs like that. But then again, maybe I did, and I just can't remember anymore. In any case, it sounds like a good sign, don't you think? How far are we? I added.
I'm not sure, she said. We're just following the painting.
What painting? I asked.
The painting on the side of the RV,
she replied. There was a long silence. An unspoken understanding that she didn't remember from where it had come either.
We can stop so you can look at it if you want,
she finally continued after a few moments. That's okay, I said. A strange feeling niggled at the back of my mind. I didn't know there was a painting, but the conversation was playing as if I should. I was in a big van with a painting on its side. So I must have seen it when I climbed in, right? I didn't know if I didn't want to see it because I should remember it, or because it seemed like now if we stopped the van and I looked at it, I'd just forget again in a few minutes anyway. The driver was fiddling with the fraying leather wrap around the steering wheel. The sun was in our eyes. How do I know you? I finally asked. I felt ashamed to ask it. I was comfortable sitting next to her there, in the passenger seat, as if we could have known each other for years. I searched her face for anger or pain, the expression I had been terrified to see on your face one day when I finally forgot something you couldn't bear. But the driver only smiled.
I don't remember either, she confessed. But we're here now.
There's just so little left, Ori. You might be the only thing that's left. I wish I hadn't run. I wish I'd stayed with you in that little dark shelter, hiding in the dim, musty ballroom. Was it a castle? A house? Resisting the pull as long as I could. But then I think about how much I've forgotten. I don't know what all of it was, but I know it was too much. Because there are so many things I can't answer anymore. And I know I couldn't have stayed. I wouldn't be able to bear it if I'd done something to you.
Why are you crying?
The woman driving next to me said.
I clicked the tape recorder off then, to finish talking to you later, and wiped my face. Is that your voice in there?
She asked.
It sounds like you.
Yes, I think so, I said.
The tires beneath us slowly lapped the cracked road under our hood, turn after turn. I could feel the steady hum of the engine.
Do you know where we're going? I asked.
Yes and no, she said.
Somehow it made sense to me. Why are we going? Is it because we know people there? I added hopefully. Maybe you're there, Ori, waiting for me? The driver shook her head.
I don't know anyone there. I don't think you do either. Or them.
I looked over the seat behind us and saw two other people dozing in the semi-darkness of the back seat, a man and a woman. How long had they been there? How long have I been here?
It's all right, she said. Once we get there, things will be better. Someone will be able to tell us why we came.
I looked down at this little machine in my hands. Will they be able to... I don't even know what exactly I need. How, but what kind? And how? Fix us?
I hope so, the driver said. I think so. They'll be able to fix you.
I looked out the window. I didn't know what else to say. I didn't think it had been a mistake, that she'd said fix you instead of fix us. I wonder what she's forgotten. How she knows that it's too much. Will I know when it's suddenly too much for me? If I forget you, will I know I have?
The One Who Gathers. It was suddenly quieter when the basement doors slammed shut, but the darkness was the same. It smelled of vomit. Then the amnesiac realized it was his own.
Gajarajan,
he moaned again. He was still clutching the bag. He was guided to the floor. One of their first aid kits popped open, and pills were pushed into his hands.
For the pain, swallow these, Dr. Avanthakar said from somewhere just above.
Someone patted his wound with cotton squares and wrapped a wide roll of fabric around his head to keep them in place. The pressure helped, slightly.
Never again. There always has to be a shadow in the group, Marie said. If something had happened to him and then to you...
It had to be me, Dr. Avanthakar returned. You know it.
The amnesiac touched the gauze band around his face softly. It was already wet, soaked through with blood. Maybe something else. Whatever soft liquid mirror was inside an eye. He swallowed the pills and rocked as he tried to wait for the fiery, searing edge of the agony to slide from murderous to simply angry. There was no point in hoping it might get better. Not a chance. When it healed, he was going to be blind.
What are we going to do?
He heard Buddy whimper.
What are we going to do? What are we going to do?
It's okay, the amnesiac managed. Everything felt so tight, like whatever was left of his remaining eye had swollen to a size that was crushing everything else in his skull.
I can still remember everything for us. I just can't see.
Marie burst out crying at that.
Please, he begged. Please. I can feel the sound. It's pounding.
His hands clawed uselessly, unable to reach into his brain, covering his ears.
I can feel it inside my head.
We need a tranquilizer,
Dr. Avanthakar said, putting her hands over his own to help drown out even more of the sound. Marie bravely strangled her sobs. Even through the doctor's soft, wrinkled hands, he heard the soft click of Marie's dreadlocks tapping one after another on each shoulder as she shook her head back and forth. Tap, 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 tap. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, 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 tap. She doesn't remember how to read, the amnesiac wanted to explain, but he just moaned. I'll do it, I can do it, Downtown said from somewhere deeper in the basement. Boxes shifted, glass vials clinked against each other. Are they okay? The amnesiac begged the dark air, prying his palms away from his ears to touch the leather bag. The book? The files? Dr. Avantikar's bony hands pushed his fingers gently out of the way. The bag zipper hissed. Everything's okay, she said after a moment. He could feel her pulling files out one by one. Some of the folder covers are a little wet, but all the papers inside are fine. Buddy, you lay these out in the back, on top of all the food boxes so they dry. My book, the amnesiac panicked, hearing all the files rustle up and away. It's here, Dr. Avantikar said, and laid the heavy binder in his lap. He clutched it to his chest. Dr. Avantikar touched the cover gently between his forearms. I never thought I'd see this again, she said. I added, I researched as much as I could before we lost the internet here. Then I stole encyclopedias from the school nearby. I added as much as I could. Told the story of Chaya again, Buddy whispered, now back in front of the amnesiac, his voice low, as if he'd squatted down to the same height so he could see the cover of the binder where the elephant's face was. Buddy, Dr. Avantikar began. Please, he protested. He always does it when I'm afraid. It's okay, the amnesiac grimaced. His hand scrambled weakly at the pages, turning them to the right place. He didn't need to see to know where the page he sought was. He knew them all so well he could do it by memory alone. Just until Downtown finds the medicine, Dr. Avantikar said to him. The amnesiac felt Buddy's knee press against his own as Buddy settled to listen, sitting close so that he could hover over the book as well. The amnesiac put his finger down on the page, on the hand-drawn image of Chaya that Hemu had pasted there. He knew it was in the right place. Sanjna, he began. The pain washed over him. A paralyzing wave. Sanjna wanted to run away and hide from her husband Surya, god of the sun, for even though she loved him, his brightness was too great for her to bear. It seared her eyes and burned her skin, and she could not even look upon him without being blinded. He tried to swallow the agony. It was so overwhelming he thought he might throw up again. Before she escaped, Sanjna took off her shadow and made it into a likeness of herself, and named it Chaya, which means shadow, Dr. Avantikar said suddenly. The amnesiac felt her hand on his shoulder, and leaned gratefully into it. His finger pointed at Hemu's scrawled text, sliding from word to word by memory, and she picked up where he had left off. She commanded Chaya to stay by Surya's side, always in her place, and fled. Even though Chaya was born that very moment, and had not lived the childhood and youth that Sanjna had, she still remembered everything from Sanjna's life, the names of all their servants, where all the belongings were in the palace, Surya's favorite dishes, because that is the place where memories are stored. In shadows. She leaned closer. She remembered so much, even the great Surya was fooled. What happened? Buddy asked, the same way he did every time. For years, Surya believed Chaya was really Sanjna. He even made a son with her, the god Shani. Perhaps if he had never found out that Sanjna had deceived him, he would have spent the rest of eternity with Chaya, never knowing Sanjna had fled. But one night, when Surya dimmed the lanterns and pulled Chaya into the bedchamber, he removed Chaya's shoes, and suddenly she began to float, because a shadow is weightless. Without her shoes, she had nothing to anchor her to the ground. Then Surya knew that she was a shadow, and not the real Sanjna. The amnesiac suddenly heard a soft clink of glass on glass. The vials from their first aid kit. The pain erupted again in anticipation, until he felt as though he was spinning in place. The binder creaked beneath his hands as he clutched it.
"What's happening?"
Buddy asked. The sound grew mercifully closer.
"Any of these?"
Downtown interrupted softly.
"I can read the labels, but..."
She gulped, unsettled.
"I don't know what they mean anymore."
Fabric rustled as Buddy hugged her. The story was forgotten as quickly as it was remembered. For once, the amnesiac didn't care at all.
"This one is fine,"
Dr. Avantikar said to Downtown. "The pain is going to get worse before it gets better." He realized she was now speaking to him, a gentle, commanding tone, the same one she'd used with Hemu. "So I'm going to put you to sleep for a few hours now." The amnesiac tried to nod. His skin prickled as it waited for a needle. Every cell in his body begged for the chemical numbness, the empty sleep that would take him away from the agony.
"Please," he managed.
"Don't worry," she said.
She pressed the book more firmly into his grip.
"I'll keep watch over them all."
Orlando Jong. It started raining again, and it rained for 4 days straight, until Ori thought they were all going to go insane from the constant wet. Then it stopped as suddenly as it had begun. The ground dried up so fiercely the mud started to crack. Heat wafted off the roads in sweltering, rippling waves, burning every inch of skin that wasn't covered. Ori kept waiting to see something on the horizon he thought was real and turned out to be a mirage, but nothing that ever materialized out of that shimmering mirror was a hallucination. Just a memory, badly mangled. There was no time to think in the day, but at night, there was plenty of time. It was so hot he couldn't sleep. He would lay shirtless on the grass, sweat beating over his upper lip, listening to everyone else snore. It reminded him of Elk Cliffs. It reminded him of Max. He wished he could tell her about that last day in D.C., about the Red King, who he really was, and that Ori had freed him. He wished he could tell her that Emmanuel had also died. He thought she'd want to know wherever she was, if she remembered Paul and Emmanuel at all anymore. Even in the heat, Amadi and Malik still went out to scout each morning, with double the water and long sleeves and hoods to shade from the sun. On the worst day, before they came back, the army had stopped for the evening an hour early, the men and horses too tired to continue. Ori was in the third carriage, making sure the corners of the tarp were still tightly folded around the books. Holmes began to whinny before the soldiers could see them, and then Amadi and Malik appeared on the horizon, shoulders hunched and clothes crisped with streaks of salt.
"Still all clear ahead?" Ori asked.
"So far," Malik said once they'd dismounted. "The whole country is empty, just fields, miles and miles of fields."
"And a funny sign," Amadi added between gulps of water from her canteen.
"A funny sign?" Ori asked.
"Someone had defaced it. Maybe the world's last graffiti," she said.
"Fuck shadows?" he guessed.
Amadi laughed.
"No, it was just a number. Just a blank sheet of metal with a number on it."
"What number?"
"I didn't look that closely," she said as she wiped her brow with the back of her arm. "It didn't mean anything. 20 or 50, maybe?"
The next day, it finally rained again, washing out the oppressive heat like the dirt from clothes strung through a river. The closer they got, the harder it was to sleep. Ori spent the hours after dinner in one carriage or another, double-checking Emmanuel's inventory. It seemed important that they be able to present an accurate account to whoever or whatever might be in New Orleans. He worked so late that Amadi and Malik had started coming to find him in the carriages once it reached midnight, to tell him to stop and sleep at least a few hours before they had to be up again.
"You need assistance,"
Vienna said once as she studied Ori from behind her father's shoulder. The soldiers who had wandered conspicuously close to catch a peek at his progress all wandered twice as quickly away.
I'll manage, Ori smiled. I'll count you scout.
Good deal,
Vienna said. She saluted.
Go to bed before your head falls off.
His head stayed on, barely. The soldiers had started whispering about the dark circles under his eyes, and he didn't help his case when he fell off the carriage the next day while trying to climb up the ladder.
Mondays, eh? Ori said as he dusted the ass of his pants off.
They chuckled, but the concerned looks returned.
General, you need a break, Original Smith finally said. Not that I'm giving you orders.
I know, Ori nodded. Don't worry. I'll have a break once we get to New Orleans. We'll all have one.
Amen to that, Original Smith said.
Ori made it safely onto the carriage that time and settled in for the long ride. That night, he was in the middle of cataloging a biography stack when the knock came on the wooden door of the carriage as usual. He opened it to see Amadee standing there, for once without her bow. She looked odd without it, friendlier.
Midnight already? He asked.
11:30.
Her voice was not soft, however. There was an extra layer of guardedness to her tone, as if to make up for the lack of her weapon. Of all the people in the army, she was the most frustrating. She had loved Paul and Emmanuel, too. He wanted to grow close to her because of that, the way he'd become with Malik, Vienna, the Smiths. But it seemed like the more he got to know Amadee, the less he felt like he actually did. Ori realized she was looking at the small stack of books beside his feet.
What's that?
She asked. He looked down. It was a pile for Max. Every night that he spent in a carriage organizing the books, he couldn't help it. He set aside a few that he thought she would like the most, just for a few hours while he worked. Then he'd put them back in with the rest, scattering them so they were as unfindable as she. But for that short time, he kept them for her. He felt like Max was there again.
Nothing,
he said.
Amadee shrugged.
Well, good, because it's lights out.
Okay, almost done for the night.
Ori,
she sighed, a warning note in her voice. He set the clipboard down and rubbed his eyes.
You know, why does everyone else around here get to go by their last name like a badass, and I have to go by my first name?
That's how you were introduced to us, she replied and shrugged. Emmanuel and Paul went by their first names. Using last names was just a Malik thing for the troops, a holdover from his time as a cop before the forgetting. He started calling the soldiers by their last names during training, and it caught on.
Am I not one of the troops? Ori insisted.
You're the general.
A general might be the head of the troops, but still a part of it, he argued.
Vienna goes by her first name,
Amadee said.
Well, that's because then we'd have two Maliks, and she's just a teenager.
Amadee threw up her hands in surrender.
You want to be Jang, Ori?
She asked. But he saw that the eye roll she threw him was joking, not annoyed.
Fine, you can be Jang. Hand over the flashlight, Jang. Don't make me fight you for it.
He knew she was serious about him stopping working, but she also had been smiling as she said it. The silly argument had put them both in a rare good mood. There was a hint of nervous teasing in her voice he hadn't heard before. Ori realized he was smiling too.
Jang.
He considered it again as he picked up the flashlight, weighing his options. He tried not to look at the small stack of books. Amadee waited just outside the carriage, grin still lingering. Her dark eyes studied him intently.
Jang.
Yes, he liked it. He liked it very much. His hand tingled slightly as it began to withdraw, to tuck itself and the light playfully behind his back, so she'd have to come closer if she wanted to take it. He wasn't sure why the name had mattered so much. Was it more about gaining something to be one of them, or leaving something else behind? Abruptly, he handed her the flashlight and stepped back into the new darkness of the carriage.
Good night, he said as he closed the door, to stop himself from thinking any further. He didn't want to think about anything at all anymore.
Hello? Hello? This voice is mine. Did I make this for myself? I sound different inside this small thing. So certain. Like I knew something I don't know now. I think I knew so many things. Now I don't know anything at all. We are driving now. There are four of us. Me. A woman with very short hair, as if it was shaved off recently and then begun to grow again. A man with an animal on his shoulder, and a woman with pale, wavy hair. There are things that make me think once there were more of us. Women's clothes that are too small for us. One backpack more than passengers. A huge, dark mark of dried blood on the floor when none of us have wounds. Or maybe it's paint. I think we are friends. They seem to think so, too. But were they not friends with you, Ori? Is that why you're not here? I can't find any sign of you. The backpack is not yours. There's a breastcloth inside. A cloth to hold the breasts close, for a woman. I can't remember the name. I don't want to look at the blood anymore. I don't think it's yours. But I don't want to ask any of them because I don't want to know. I feel... I'm not sure. It hurts deep inside. When I stand, my head pounds and I grow dizzy, and my hands shake sometimes. Each day is worse. The others seem to have it too. Sometimes the pain is so bad I just lay on the ground inside our big car, holding my middle, waiting for it to pass. I know there was something I used to do to stop this, but I don't know what. Partway through the afternoon, the man with an animal living on his arm suddenly sat up and looked nervously at the woman with short hair, who was driving.
"Where are we going?"
he asked. The creature snarled and circled his biceps, dodging freckles. The woman with short hair cocked her head, and then her eyes went wide too. She pressed her foot down and we all slid forward as the big car ground to a halt.
"I don't know," she said.
"Should we keep going?" the golden-haired woman, also in the back seat, asked. The man with an animal arm peered through the slats out the window.
"Let's get out and look around," he said.
Outside, the air was sweet and warm. It smelled like honey and dust. I closed my eyes, but turned my face up so it could soak into my skin.
"We're on a road,"
the man observed. "But heading for what?" the pale-haired woman asked.
"This," the driver said.
We all turned and saw her facing not the road, but the side of the big car instead. "Oh," we all murmured at once. It was gigantic. The sun, the road, the big car, and its long, stretching shadow. "This is you," I said, and pointed at a painted woman with a smooth head.
"And you,"
the man replied to me, and pointed at another woman with brown skin and a huge mass of tightly wound curls springing off her head in all directions. On another man, we could clearly see the black outline of an animal on his arm. The woman with pale hair was painted next to him. They looked at each other hesitantly. In the painting, they were holding hands. There were others, too, but we didn't know who they were. "I looked for you too, Ori, but I didn't see you there. Where are you?"
"It's a message to stay on this big road until we find that," the driver finally pronounced.
She pointed at a cluster of black and colored shapes at the end of the painting.
"We have to go there."
"The place," the blonde woman said. She glanced at the animal-armed man, but neither of them moved closer to each other.
"Let's drive," the driver said.
Soft floating water has started falling from the sky.
Not as one great body, but in millions of tiny fragments. It acts like rain, but I know it's not. I remember that much. It glitters silver as it drops, so everything in front of us is shimmering. We're all crouched in the driver's cabin, peering out the front window to watch it.
That's...
the animal on the man's arm said, but I've already forgotten what the creature called it. The driver figured out how to lower the window so that a slice of the outside sky reached into our moving home. We all stuck our hands out, mesmerized. Ari, you wouldn't believe. It was cold. So cold to the touch it burned when the little shards landed on our fingertips. It wasn't water at all. It was something else. The driver pulled her hand in at once, hissing in surprise, but I left mine out there. I cupped my palm to try to collect as many as possible. I endured it as long as I could. My hand was white fire. But then when I pulled it in, there were only a few little silver crystals there. The rest had vanished somehow, and my fingers were misted with a light, wet sheen. "What's it called again?" I asked the creature on the man's arm again. It repeated the name, but it was gone from me once more as soon as I heard it. The road has been bumpy for miles now. I don't know why. I almost dropped this small plastic thing as I examined it. Beside me, a woman with very short hair is grimacing as she looks through the front window, and keeps pushing her feet against the floor.
"Wait,"
someone behind us said. I turned around. There was a person in the back seat. A man. He stood up and gripped the back of my chair.
"Wait, where am I? Where are we going?"
"We..." the driver started to answer, but then she shook her head. They both turned to me, but I shrugged also, feeling a tingle of fear start to rise in my chest. "I don't know either." We slowed our house down until it stopped. The door was jammed, but the man pushed it open with the face of the beast living on his shoulder, and the three of us stepped out into the grass. So much green everywhere. It seemed like we had come from nowhere, and we were going nowhere either.
"Do you think we did this?"
the man asked. I turned away from the emerald forever to see him studying our moving house. The entire wall of it was one massive, breathtaking painting.
"We must have," the woman driving us said. "We must have made it to remind us."
The man brushed his arm absently, as if the wind was tickling the skin. His fingers came away lightly tangled in a long strand of golden, silky hair.
"I keep finding them on my clothes."
He shrugged, having no explanation.
"I don't know why."
I climbed up the stairs after him, followed by the driving woman, who took another long look at the painting, to make sure it matched the road we were on. "Do you think we've done this before?" I asked her over the breeze.
"Done what?"
"Forgotten where we were going, and then saw the painting and decided to follow it."
"I'm not sure. But yes, I think so," she said.
"How many times do you think it's happened?" She licked her lips slowly as she stared off into the distance.
"Maybe 10. She closed her eyes. "Maybe 1,000.
Before I ducked inside, I glanced back one more time, to make sure I hadn't missed it. But no, none of the people in the picture looked like you.
Mana's Amadi. Nuz left the camp at dawn, long before most of the others were awake. She had orders from Malik to set out early with Original Smith and Dose to scout the road ahead of the army. She was to push all the way to Chattanooga, to see if the I-24 was still intact enough to allow them to cross through the ruins of the city, rather than having to work 5 wooden-wheeled carriages through the uneven mountains. "I want a loose triangle, 20 feet between each of us, on the ready at all times," she ordered as she secured her fiberglass bow across the back of her saddle. The black liquid surface shimmered in the morning light.
Yes, ma'am.
The two Smiths saluted.
Watch for mud,
Malik said as he handed her a piece of jerky wrapped in a thin cloth.
Runoff from the mountains could make everything soft.
I'll bring the horses back, Nuz smiled down to him.
Yourself, too, he warned.
They set off at a canter, but soon they were trotting, then simply walking, picking their way through the firmest ground as the road narrowed, then fell off into nothing. At one point, her horse's hoof tipped something small and curved, and it rolled to the top of the grass and lay still. Half a skull. Nuz studied it as they passed, wondering why it looked so strange. It wasn't until she was almost past it that she realized it was because it had been child-sized. It's human, no more than 5. After that, she stopped looking so closely at the bones. Doz checked the compass, while Nuz and Original Smith scanned the horizon with their bows. They had a few guns, but these were worth more at the caravan than with the scouts. Ori, Jong now, had argued with her several times to take at least one when she went out on forward duty, and wouldn't give up no matter how adamantly she refused. Other times, he seemed not to care at all. They would go days without speaking, but then suddenly every single thing she said to him would make the muscles in his jaw tighten, as if he could barely manage the strain of being with them all. Other days she'd come back in from a ride covered in dust, and want nothing more than to eat all the food in the camp and joke with Vienna by the fire, and he'd be beside her, practically teary-eyed with relief that she'd survived, begging her again to take a gun next time, any gun, to do it for him, please, that he could not lose another. Then the gears would abruptly shift again, and 3 days would go by before she realized she hadn't seen him since.
Something at 11 o'clock,
Doz whispered, her bow snapping up.
Dinner, Original Smith said. It's a deer.
The deer glanced up from grazing and froze, perfectly still as it stared at them. But Doz didn't let fly the arrow.
Whoa,
Nuz finally said. It was indeed a deer, but the head was wrong. From the roots of its bony antlers sprouted 2 small, unfurled sparrow wings, a feathered crown.
Don't shoot it,
she murmured.
It's the same kind of thing as that weird rabbit-pig-frog animal,
Original Smith said as he lowered his own bow, even though it wasn't. Those little creatures were funny, stupid. The deer, on the other hand, was not. The deer was terrifying because it was almost beautiful.
Fuck it, whatever it is,
Doz spat and crossed herself. There better not be another disappearing, reappearing lake nearby.
Enough!
Nuz broke her stare at the strange creature and swatted Dose's thin arm with the tail of an arrow to draw her attention back to the path. It was newly made, the wood a lighter color. Each night, when they broke for camp, she'd been teaching the soldiers how to make them. They needed all they could get.
Forget the deer. Let's keep it moving.
She lowered her voice.
I don't like it here. Something's off.
The deer started when the horses began to walk again, wings disappearing, folding tight against its head as it dashed into the underbrush. Nuz saw Original Smith and Doz look at each other as the disturbed foliage where it had run grew still again. She could see they felt it, too. The on-ramp to the freeway was destroyed, so they stood in the parking lot of a ruined donut shop, staring out across the wreckage of the city. Tiny pieces of ash billowed in the air in front of them, even at such a distance.
Anyone know what we're looking at?
Nuz asked.
Downtown?
Doz offered. She shivered, even though it was much warmer there than it was in D.C. The downtown is west of the I-24, right?
I've never been to Chattanooga, Original Smith murmured.
It doesn't matter anyway, Nuz said.
It didn't. It really didn't. Chattanooga was on fire. As far as they could see, north to south, a raging blaze curdled the skyline, yellow and red flames spewing black clouds that spread for miles.
How long do you think it's been like that?
Original Smith asked.
I have no idea,
Nuz said. They watched it for a little while longer. Maybe since the first day. She couldn't imagine what could cause a fire that size, or cause it to burn so long. Whatever it was, there was nothing to do. There was no Chattanooga anymore.
What do we do now? Dose asked. We can't take the freeway through that. Can the carriages manage on terrain until we can find a smaller road around?
One thing at a time, Nuz said. Somehow it was hard to look away. Pretty, Original Smith finally said. Somewhere just north of the last standing skyscrapers, an explosion sent a glittering wave of molten glass through the square maze of streets.
Is that a weird thing to say?
Nuz shook her head slowly, transfixed. She understood what he meant.
I wonder if it'll ever burn out, she said.
Just then, a spear, painted red and adorned with crimson strips of fabric, punched itself through the front of Dose's throat. The One Who Gathers. When he woke, the pain was not better. It was so terrible, at first the amnesiac couldn't even cry out. When he finally could, he bit his tongue instead, and tried to sense the state of things without his sight. Dr. Avantikar and the Shadowless were on the other side of the basement, where they could talk without disturbing him too much. He sat up as gently as possible. The pain whittled itself from acid into a spear in his skull. He squeezed the Gajarajan book in his hands to keep from moaning, until the spear dissolved into acid again.
The pre-storm, Marie was saying softly. The hurricane is likely just beginning to touch down now.
It's too late, Downtown added. Even if the facility upstairs has finished collapsing, we can't cross the city. We'll be swept away in the floods.
Damn it, Curly growled. A hand smacked plastic. Three sharp bursts. Fucking things!
Flashlights, Downtown said, filling in the word he'd lost. The amnesiac wondered if his shadow was blind the way he was now. Or could it always see, even though he no longer could and never would again? He wondered if he'd know it now if his shadow ever left. Would he feel it immediately? Or would he wander around for some unknowable amount of time without it, before someone else noticed and told him? The amnesiac imagined it as it would be on the wall behind him, in the same posture, listening to the same conversation in companionable silence. Dr. Avantikar was arguing with Marie now, debating the statistical probability of leaving and dying versus staying and dying. Downtown was calling for a vote. The amnesiac took a deep breath, imagined his shadow doing the same, its charcoal outline expanding and contracting. That is, if Curly had gotten the flashlight back on again, if there was any light to see it by, or if it was still pitch dark. There was no way for him to know at all. Whatever the hurricane morphed into would probably destroy New Orleans and kill them. But there was something else, too. He could feel it. Something else was growing, or coming. The Gajarajan book in his hands was comfortingly heavy. He slowly turned the pages, sliding his fingers in and easing each leaf over. Just like Surya and Chaya's story, he knew what article, what picture, what scribbled notes from his old friend were beneath his palm every time he set it down. Pieces of Peter Pan, clippings about Hemu Joshi from the Maharashtra Times, mathematics, astronomy, entries from Hemu's own fractured, desperate diary, more excerpts from the Rig Veda, and most of all, by far, photographs of the great elephant himself at Guruvayur Temple, and stories of its incredible, inexplicable feats of memory. Hundreds of these pages read over and over until they were memorized, compared to a handful of note cards about the amnesiac's former life that he'd lost long ago and never cared about anyway. He knew Gajarajan more intimately than he would ever know his old self. It almost felt like he was more elephant than man. Eventually, The amnesiac realized he was barely listening to the others. He was being drawn in by something else, a subtle feeling he'd not noticed that he actually had noticed at first, and then all of a sudden did. It was like waking up from a dream about the ocean and realizing you were floating in water. Something was happening. "Dr. Avantikar," he murmured, but she didn't hear him. She kept talking. "Dr. Avantikar," he repeated, still sitting, facing whichever way he'd been positioned when he was helped to the floor. "Doctor." "No, you need rest, not..." She started, but when she finally turned to face him, everything dropped. Her voice, the anger, whatever the rest of them had been arguing about. "I don't know," the amnesiac said at last. He didn't know. There was a feeling, but without his eyes, every sensation was nonsense. But Dr. Avantikar was still frozen in place, still completely silent. The other shadowless weren't speaking anymore either. In the whole room, almost no one breathed. If it had been only that he had become shadowless, they would have moved by now. They would have come over to console him. They were long used to seeing shadows disappear. But something was different. The seconds crawled by. They remained paralyzed by their sight. "What should I do?" the amnesiac finally asked. "Nothing," Dr. Avantikar said. He heard her take a small step forward. No one else moved. The amnesiac did nothing. He waited. The air in the room felt almost solid. "It's okay," Dr. Avantikar said softly. "What?" But she wasn't speaking to him, he realized. "It's okay," she said again. "Yes," he agreed, trying to sound convincing. The wall behind him, where his shadow was smoothly stretched, felt as though it had expanded to contain everything in the world. "It's okay." The amnesiac tried to hold as still as he could.
"Did you see that?"
Dr. Avantikar gasped. She was beyond realizing he couldn't have. Something had gripped her, gripped them all. Terror or wonder.
"Did you see?"
she whispered. She couldn't say anything else. They all waited, bound in place, staring. And then it came again. The sensation that he had turned his head to look around when he had not moved at all.
"Did you see?"
Dr. Avantikar whispered again, close to madness. A voice that did not come from the amnesiac's mouth, but sounded very much the same, said, "I know how we can stop the hurricane." Orlando Jong. The noon sun was sweltering, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. On horseback, Malik reached up to take his newly made bow off his shoulder and hook it on the saddle instead, but when his bare fingers touched the hammered metal tips that kept the string in place, he cursed and let go on instinct. The bow slid off his shoulders and smacked the dirt. "Damn it," he growled. "It's hotter than hell." From her horse beside Jong's carriage, Vienna clicked her tongue.
"Amity isn't going to like that," she said. "He better clean the string well."
They had been talking about Amity as the carriages ambled along. "When did she move to the United States?" Jong asked. She'd mentioned Tehran a few times, but he'd gotten the sense that it was a thing she looked at only from the periphery, never head-on, the way he now did with Max. It was just too painful.
"When she was about my age, I think,"
Vienna answered as her horse flicked its head. Jong tried to imagine what that would have been like, to move from that far so young. Now it was impossible. Without shadows, Iran seemed like a place that was so unreachable from where they were. It didn't exist anymore. Maybe it actually didn't.
"She wanted to go to the Olympics for archery," Vienna continued. "Apparently the best coach in the world was living in Boston before the forgetting. When she joined our army, she trained everyone. She started teaching us all how to make bows and arrows."
"You can shoot as well?" Jong asked.
"Well, guns are easier, but I'm getting better."
"You'll have to teach me then," he said.
definitely, she cried, and then grew suddenly bashful at her outburst. Are you also from, like, China or something? She asked.
No, Arlington, Jung replied. He'd almost said we. We came from Arlington. There was no we anymore. No Max.
Well, before that, Portland, he finally said. I grew up in Portland, Oregon.
With Paul?